Jon Oates is a legendary musician who is best known as one half of Hall & Oates. He was in Austin for South by Southwest 2024 this year, which provided me an opportunity to sit down with Jon to talk about his life in and away from music and a whole lot more. We are officially rolling now, so okay. I apologize for having you repeat yourself, but this is just blew my mind. But then again, you're full of these mind-blowing moments throughout your career, and I can't wait to talk about the solo career, Jon.
Sure.
But I just asked you if this was your first South By. I feel like I'd seen you before, but I definitely hadn't seen you this far back. You were a part of the very first South By Southwest.
Yeah, unless someone can prove me wrong, I believe it was the first one. It was really not much. It was this kind of fledgling music conference in the basement of the Four Seasons Hotel in the bar area, and it was just a little stage, and I was working with an artist from Oklahoma named Jerry Lynn Williams, and we were trying to promote his new project on CBS that he was signed to, and we showed up and we did a couple songs and we met some people from Nashville, and that was it. Look what's happened.
Yeah, no kidding. Have you done some other South By since then?
No, I haven't been back since.
This is your very first one in all that time.
Yeah, it's culture shock in a big way.
Mind-blowing, I'd say.
Yeah, mind-blowing, yes.
Because it started out as a music festival, as you're well aware. Yeah. Now it's a little bit of everything, you know?
I guess it's a lifestyle experience, right?
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. So part of what you're here for, you're here for a panel discussion on the business of making music, which I'm sure is really exciting for you to get to talk about as somebody who's as creative as you are.
Well, I don't know whether I'm excited about talking about the business of the music business, but it's a reality that, you know, I do have a lot of experience with.
Yeah.
And it's probably my least favorite thing about the music business, because I do like to emphasize the creative side. You know, that's what I'm really all about. But I guess since I've been through the wars, so to speak, I have a certain perspective on it.
Yeah, an old saying goes, the worst part about music is the business.
Yeah, right.
But you do have a ton of experience in that regard. A lot of people don't have to worry about the business side at the very beginning. Thinking back all these years, do you find yourself just recollecting or maybe romanticizing the very beginning a little bit more because it was so purely about the creative side of things?
Well, I can romanticize it now that it's so far behind me. But when you're young and starting out, you really don't care. All you want to do is play and sing and write and get a record contract. And, you know, especially back in the old days, that was the paradigm, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, get a record deal, you know, that was the ultimate goal. You didn't really care. And, you know, to be honest with you, you know, if someone threw a piece of paper in front of you, you just sign it, you know, and the consequences be damned, you know, and certainly I did that. I remember the first record contract I ever signed was with my high school band in 1966 or 67. We went down and paid the money to a little studio in Philadelphia, went in, made a record, and then I literally took this acetate. It was called an acetate back in those days. It was literally like a test pressing of a vinyl 45, and went down to this place called the Record Museum in Philadelphia, which sold singles, 45s, and I walked in and I spoke to this guy behind the counter, and I said, hey, you know, you want to hear this record we just made? And the guy said, oh, yeah. He put it on the turntable. He goes, what are you doing? I said, I don't know. We're looking to get it on the radio. He said, come on in the back room. They threw down some paper. I signed it. I didn't even read it. I was like, you're going to put this out? And they said, yeah. I said, okay. I just signed it. I had no idea what I was signing or what it meant. And all I cared about was going to, and you know what? It got on the radio in Philadelphia. Unfortunately, a portent things to come for me, being a bit too ignorant about the business. And I've learned a lot over the years. Let's put it that way.
Wow, that's great. So even if it wasn't
believe me, that is not a unique story.
Even if it wasn't a great deal for you, there was still a means to an end there.
I wouldn't have cared what they did as long as I had a record deal. I mean, seriously, it was that kind of thing. And, you know, you can look. I mean, I know there's tons of these stories in the history of the music business. The old story about the blues men, you know, going to Chicago and signing, you know, give this guy a bottle of wine and take his royalties for the rest of his life. You know?
Deal with the devil.
Absolutely. It's a common, it's more common than not in the music business. Of course, today's musicians are much more sophisticated. They have a lot more, you know, information at their disposal, and they they definitely approach it in a different way. But then again, the music business is completely different. It's not really the same type of business that it was back in the old days.
Man, what a wild time, not only to be alive in the mid to late 1960s, but to actually be making music during that time,
well,
too.
I was just 17, you know, so.
Crazy. Yeah. So the other reason why you're here in Austin, which I am personally a little bit more excited about, is you are one of the headliners for the Luck Festival, Willie Nelson's Luck Festival, happening
so
in Spicewood
amazing.
On Thursday, March 14th.
Yes.
Have you spent much time around Willie in the past, considering that this is his namesake?
No, I really haven't. I know a few of the folks in his band, like Mickey Raphael, who's his harmonica player. In fact, we rode down on the plane together.
Hmm.
And I know Lucas. And Lucas and I wrote some songs. We tried to write a song, and we hung out together. I'm a big fan of Lucas, and so it'll be nice to see him. And there's a bunch of cool people on the bill, and I'm just excited about the whole atmosphere. From what I've heard, I've never been there, so I've heard it's a really vibey Western town with all these things. And we're playing in the chapel, at the chapel stage, which I believe is an old church or an old converted church. So that should be really cool. I'm looking forward to it, and hopefully, you know, we'll get the opportunity to hang with some of the other artists and see what happens.
I love what's going on with your solo career right now. Are you still in the middle of the tour that is essentially just you with an acoustic guitar? There's a cello on stage as well.
Yeah.
You telling stories and singing songs?
Started this a few years ago, and I've been playing it all over the world. I'm calling it an evening of songs and stories. It's an acoustic-based show. I have a percussionist and a cello player, and I've just recently added another guitarist and a pedal steel player, so I'm expanding the band a little bit. But I've wanted to keep it really streamlined and really basic and really organic and acoustic. So it's a chance for me. It's more of a retrospective to kind of play songs that were influential to me as a kid growing up, kind of things that made me want to be a musician, want to learn to play the guitar and sing, things that turned me on as everything from the earliest days of rock and roll to the stuff that my parents played for me, the big band and the swing music of the 30s and 40s, and then on to the folk revival and all the folk great, amazing roots and important folk artists that were being rediscovered in the early 60s and brought up to the Northeast, especially to the college campuses. All that stuff was really important to me. So my whole musical identity is a blending of all the things that I experienced from the time I was a kid. And I try to bring that out in the show.
And people are going to get to hear your latest single, I'm assuming, at most of the stops, Get Your Smile On. Man, what a cool, chill, sultry groove. It's got that old school, like 80s, 90s R&B feel about it. What was the inspiration there?
Well, you're not going to believe it when I tell you. I wrote that during the pandemic.
Okay.
And because I couldn't go to a recording studio and I was really, I wasn't collaborating with anyone. I was on my own. And I create a lot of my stuff, especially my home demos, on GarageBand, which is an Apple app, a program on Apple. And I've been involved in GarageBand ever since it started, when they first introduced it, because I'm not a very good engineer, and I like the simplicity, and I'm really good at it now, so I can get things done really quickly, and I don't have to bog myself down with engineering, which I really suck at. So I recorded that entire song on GarageBand. I played all the parts, sang everything, and I used one microphone, and that was it. It was the whole thing. And so, to me, it was this kind of...
Hold on a second. Does Apple know this? Because I feel like Apple...
Yeah, actually the guys at Apple Music do know that.
Thank goodness.
And there's another aspect to it as well. I'll talk about that later.
Sure.
So I recorded this thing, and to me, it was just a way to spend some time and to really get into it. But I took it to a whole other level. I really paid a lot of attention to the sounds and everything that I was doing. And then I didn't think about it. I tossed it into my digital pile of stuff. And I got an invite by Roger Daltrey to be an ambassador for Teen Cancer America.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, you know, I like to do things, you know, kind of give back as much as I can. So I thought, well, this is really cool. And they have a real big musical component for this teen cancer art organization. There's a lot of the kids, you know, like to play and sing and write, whatever. So they asked me if I could do something musical. And I said, wait a minute. And I thought, this song seems like it's tailor-made for this, you know, something about, it was just about being positive, keep smiling, keep positive, you know. And I thought, so I sent it to them, and they loved it. And they said, well, let's put it out. I said, okay. I mean, literally, I wasn't thinking about it at all. That's how it came out. And in fact, I just happening yesterday, The Who are doing a special performance in California on May 4th, I believe it is. Mm-hmm. And they asked me to come out and sing that song with them. So I'm going to be on stage with The Who. Now, who would have ever thunk it? Who? Get it? Did you get that? Okay. Slip that in.
I like that.
Thank you.
Good dad joke there.
Thank you. Oh, boy.
I'm the father of a 9 and 7 year old, so right. I really appreciate the dad joke.
I'm the father of a 29 year old. So, yeah, it never ends, by the way.
It gets a little bit easier when they're adults,
no,
right?
No, little kids, little problems, big kids, big problems. It's yeah. Okay. It's still fun. But anyway, yeah, so they love the song, and I'm going to get a chance to perform it with them. So I don't know how that's going to work. I can't actually picture The Who playing that song, but it sounds like maybe they'll turn it into a heavy metal song, which could also be very cool.
Oh, wow. Well, you're not opposed to that either.
I'm not
because
opposed to anything.
I mean, Maneater started out as a reggae
That's
song,
right.
And Daryl steps in and says, hey, I think for popular sensibilities, it may work better like this. He wasn't incorrect, but...
He was right. He was absolutely right. The groove that he came up with turned that song into a major hit, which is great. Believe me, I'm not complaining. But at the same time, I got to go to Jamaica about, I guess it was almost 2 years ago now, and record it with some of the legends of reggae, the guys that play with Marley and Toots. And the Maytals and Tosh. And we did a proper reggae session, you know. And I like to joke, when I don't really actually remember anything that happened during that session since we were in Kingston, Jamaica in this little tiny room. You can let your imagination run wild.
Hopefully nobody's shooting sheriffs.
No, there was no shooting involved. There was a lot of smoking involved.
Three Little Birds,
not
okay.
Not for me, but but I think I got a contact high from the experience. But
there
was,
are worse places
amazing.
To get the contact high.
That's right.
Gosh, Toots has one of the all-time great cover songs with Country Road by John Denver. I don't know if you've heard that one before.
Yeah.
You have covered Maneater. You put it out last year. It's available on Spotify right now.
I put the reggae version.
Exactly, yep. The original reggae version, which I thought sounded really freaking
Thanks.
Cool.
Yeah, appreciate
In
it.
Terms of all the stuff that you've made over the years, what is the favorite cover that you've heard of your own work?
Interesting. You know, there's been a few. But to be honest with you, considering how many hits Hall & Oates has had, if you actually think about the covers, there's hardly any. Hmm. It's really weird. Lou Rawls did a version of She's Gone. I think it was Nina Simone did Rich Girl or Sarah Smile. There's been some really like kind of unique covers. There hasn't been a lot of really big pop covers, though.
Hmm.
I think it has to do with the type of chords and the type of melodies that we were using that don't always sit comfortably with other singers. I don't know why, but...
It's just hard to pull it all off together?
Maybe. I don't know. It just doesn't seem to have connected with other artists to cover.
Hmm. So you toured pretty much nonstop for 14 years, from 72 to 86, and you decided, you made a conscious effort to take a long break at that point. Mm-hmm. You spend almost 10 years, moved from New York to Colorado.
Yep.
Great move, by the way. You want to talk about natural beauty year-round, and really do hit that reset button. Why was that so important for you personally, and how did it change you as a person when you came out the other side?
Well, there's a lot of things to that. You know, I had dedicated myself to my music career, which meant writing, recording, touring. It never stopped. I mean, it started in the early 70s, went straight up through 86, and I never really did anything else except that. I felt like there was something missing in my life, and that coincided with a few other things. It coincided with me getting a divorce, with our manager leaving us and moving on, and... It felt like the rudder fell off the ship, for me personally. And I just said, if I'm going to, I felt like I would burn out or do something stupid if I kept trying to chase the, you know, stay on the hamster wheel.
Mm-hmm.
So I just said, I'm going to stop. At the time, we were at the top of our game commercially. We were having hit after hit.
Probably, y'all just headlined Rite Aid.
Oh, yeah. We did Live Aid.
We
had done the Live at the Apollo with Eddie Kendrick and David Ruffin. We did We Are the World. We had multiple American Music Awards. You know, I mean, yeah, we were at the top of the of our commercial game at that moment. So it probably wasn't the best thing to do from that point of view, but for me personally, it was the best thing I ever did. And I just, I had to recalibrate. I had to start over again. And that's what I did. And I had a little condo in Aspen, Colorado, and I knew I was living in New York and Connecticut at the time, and I just knew that if I just stayed there and did the same thing that I was doing, that nothing would change, and that I needed to really just rethink it. So I basically
because Connecticut's not far enough away. Even though it is
still New York. Yeah. To me, it was all the same. And I sold everything I had, and I literally sold everything I had. I had houses. I had a house, apartment. I had a collection of sports cars. I had an airplane. I sold everything and I left. And I got in my little car and drove to Colorado, moved into my little one bedroom condo, and I started over again. Hmm. And I in fact, I even sold the car when I got out there, and I rode my bike for 2 years. Even in the winter, I put studded tires on my mountain bike. I had a basket. I'd ride to the supermarket, get my food, ride back in the middle of a snowstorm, went backcountry skiing. I learned how to backcountry ski. I went hiking, went biking, you know, and I just started over again. And I hung out with a bunch of people who didn't care whether I was a rock star or a musician for that matter.
Yeah.
It was just how, you know, can you keep up when we're skiing powder, you know? I learned, you know, I skied 100 days a year, basically for 10 years straight, and became a pretty good skier.
You still get to ski?
I don't ski anymore because I got hurt a few times. Mm. I cross-country ski now.
Okay.
I do skate skiing, you know, and which is great for the fitness, but at least I won't hit a tree and I won't get whacked by a snowboarder. So
yeah.
I figured that's okay. But I love being out there. I love the summers. I still, I just bought my first e-bike. It's a full-out, you know, hardcore mountain bike. And now I'm back to mountain biking again, which is amazing. And so, yes, I want to spend a little more time out there again. We haven't abandoned it, but we're still in Nashville pretty much.
Excellent. And so you have also gained a really good grasp of a couple of things that are hard for creative types to come to terms with. One is gaining complete creative autonomy, which you have now. The other thing is being able to embrace the past enough and the things that have helped you to create a sort of freedom for yourself. Did that also happen as a result of Colorado too?
Yeah, it gave me a chance to step out of the of that world that I was in, but also not abandon it completely and understand the value of what that gate that enabled me to do, just like you said. And what it did enable me to do, it put me in a certain place personally with in terms of notoriety, fame, whatever you want to call it. But at the same time, I wasn't chained to it anymore. And I got remarried and had a kid, built a house, did all the things that I couldn't do when I was touring for 70s and 80s. And that really changed everything. So now, then at that point, music became part of my life and not the all-consuming, thrust of my life. And then by the late 90s, I started getting the itch again to make more music. And I began to meet some people who I could work with and started to put my toes in the water, began to go to Nashville, try to write some country songs, which I was an absolute failure at. But
Why is that? That seems like it would be, there'd be a natural connection there.
The sensibility just didn't work for me.
Huh.
But what did happen was I became part of the early days of the Americana Music Association. And I met people like Jerry Douglas and Sam Bush and Bela Fleck and Jim Lauderdale and guys who have become really, really good friends. But at the same time, when I started to get to know them and play with them, they had a lot of the same early influences growing up. They listened to the same music. And all of a sudden, I had this kind of, I created this family of like-minded musicians who I could, they understood where I was coming from and it could bring that out in me. Hmm. And I went, so in a sense, I went back to go forward. I went back to my earliest roots, used that as a jumping off point and kept working at that, creating an individual sound and an individual musical personality that was based more on where I came from as opposed to Hall & Oates.
Interesting. As far as the country is concerned, were you trying more of that newer style at the time, the Brooks and Dunn style, or were you going old school honky tonk with your country?
Neither. It just didn't work. I don't know. I wrote with a bunch of country songwriters, some of the best in Nashville, and nothing ever clicked. And it really was, I think I just had to find my own path, you know?
Yeah.
What was that Casey Musgraves song, or Follow Your Arrow, or whatever that was?
Yeah.
Basically, that's what I did. And now I have I have this great musical team, family, whatever you want to call it, in Nashville, who I make my records with. And we kind of keep it, you know, it's kind of enclosed. We have our own little world. And what's really happened in the new Nashville is that I found that many, many artists who have moved there or whatever have done the same thing. They basically, you know, there's all these little pods and teams of people who kind of work together. You know, you can't work with everyone because there's so many amazing artists. It's kind of, you can find your own, you know, you find your own way and your own kind of method, I guess.
So you, like a lot of people, have taken special interest in AI over the last few years. South by Southwest does a lot with regards to trying to help merge human interaction with artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. Where are you with all of that right now? Because to be frank, it terrifies me because we don't have enough guardrails in place and people who are responsible for advancing this technology, making sure to protect humans in the process.
Well, yeah, I know there's a lot of legislation happening in Tennessee. They're working on the Elvis law to do some. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that has to be addressed and has to be, you know, I don't think you can control it, but I think you can monitor it and fashion it. I'm interested in it. And in fact, on one of my singles that I released last year, we were going to do a video and I had no visual concept for this particular song. And just as a kind of a lark or a joke, I just said to the company I was working with, I said, is there anybody can do an AI video on this song? Because I would be curious to see what happens. And we found someone and they created this AI, created a music video for this song. I'm trying to remember the name of the song. I can play it, but I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, but the video was kind of weird because it wasn't anything that I would have done. And I don't drink, and my wife was kind of got mad at me because the character who was me in the AI video kept diving into a glass of beer, which was really weird too.
Yeah.
I don't know where that all came from, but it was kind of a crazy experiment. It'd be interesting to see what happens. The one thing that I feel pretty strongly about, though, is that nothing can ever really replace the live experience of someone performing and playing.
You say that, but the Tupac hologram performed at Coachella a couple years ago.
I know, but it's a hologram, and it's going to do what a hologram is programmed to do.
Yeah.
If I'm on stage and many other artists, if we want to play a different song or someone shouts out something from the audience, I don't know if a hologram can respond to that, although with sophistication, I'm sure they can figure that out too. It's a brave new world. I don't know. All I know is I'm old enough to not worry about having to see it. So I don't really care.
Yeah, that's you're right about that. And part of me thinks that too. Like maybe this is like 100 years off before the total.
It's not 100 years off.
No, it's not.
I think the curve's going.
You're also a big car enthusiast.
Oh, yeah.
Technology with that just continues to go crazy too.
Well, and not for me. I'm old school.
So I like
the old stuff.
Well, I like to hear that. And I've heard you talk about just pumping the brakes on fully electric vehicles so far. There's things that haven't been accounted for, even though the initial idea may not be terrible. Where's all this electricity going to come from? And by the way, people don't realize this also, John, but a lot of these cars are several times the weight of a normal automobile, which is going to have an impact on the infrastructure in this country too.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of issues with it. Also, the actual source materials to create electric vehicles and batteries in particular is really environmentally terrible. You know,
there is an environmental cost too that is not talked about enough. You're right about that.
There's a lot of things going on with that. I mean, you can't stop progress. And so, you know, I mean, if you want my 2 cents, I think the way to go is, and which is actually what Toyota's doing, is building super efficient gas engines.
Yep.
Small displacement, high powered gas engines, like three cylinders with a turbocharger that create good amount of horsepower with a battery support, but not a plug-in, whereby the ICE is charging the battery, and the battery is supplementing the power of this very efficient gas engine.
It creates the energy that it can then be used for the lower speeds.
I think for now, that's the way to go. If you really want to be sensible and do that. And I think there's companies that are starting to rethink the electric concept, because I was in a showroom the other day with a friend of mine, and the salesman in the showroom said, he pointed out this out in the, you know, in outside on the lot. He said, we can't sell these cars. Mm. And most of them were electric.
So you turn 76 next month. Like many, I marvel at your youthful spirit. You look great. You sound great. You're thinking great. You've got it all going on, man.
And so far, so good.
Yeah, so far, so good. I hear a lot of artists who have to take the stage in front of a live audience, musicians, stand-up comedians feel this way too, that you never really lose the butterflies, and you learn to accept that that's actually a healthy thing. So I'm curious for you, as somebody who has that youthful spirit, because that feeling of awe is much harder to come by as you continue to get older. The world doesn't surprise you as much. And quite frankly, people get complacent with finding ways to keep themselves surprised or on their toes. So do you still get those butterflies when you take stage? And what do you find that awes you right now?
I don't get butterflies.
Okay.
I've been on stage since I've been 4 years old.
Yeah.
To me, it's just like, that's what I do. I just
old
walk
habit.
Out there. But I get excited, and I have an anticipation for doing it. One of the reasons I'm doing this show that I'm doing now is because I have to hold down a lot of musical responsibility in the show, because I'm really the only one playing the chord changes. I'm the one that came up with the arrangements, you know, me, the ultimate situation for a rock star. It's very challenging to do what I do. Because I don't have the support of a big band with amplifiers and production and video screens and all this other stuff that can kind of carry you along a little bit. I'm very similar to a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
I'm kind of out there on my own.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why I'm really doing it, because it actually keeps me thinking, keeps my brain working, forces me to stay on top of my game. And it's not always easy. And I'm playing acoustic guitar, which physically, from a physical point of view as a musician, is much harder than electric guitar, because just is, you know, they just don't play as easily. And there's more things going on an acoustic guitar. With an electric, you plug in, you get a great sound with your pedal board, crank your amp up, and, you know, nice low action, light gauge strings, you know, you can, it's pretty easy. Every time I pick up an electric guitar, I go, wow, this is great. but with the acoustic guitar, it's more physical, you know, there's a lot to it. But I love that. And so it's challenged me to be better and to stay on top of my own ability, which as you get older, it's actually more important than ever to stay on top of it.
Well, it's interesting to think about the spoken word element to these shows too, in these more intimate settings, because that really is where you're like a stand-up, where it's stories that you've probably been telling for years now, and you have to learn to make the proper tweaks to make it a little bit more concise, or to know where you're going to get that laugh.
The show has evolved over the last few years. I know which stories work the best. I know when to put them in, when not to put them in, and I can sense from the audience as well. And then I always have to remind my guys in my band, I said, just make sure you're acting like you heard these for the first time, because it's pretty funny.
How often do you insert a new story?
It depends. What I've been doing, since I just made a new album, the album's called Reunion, by the way, and the single comes out April 3rd. I might as well plug it.
Oh, yes, please do.
Yes, it's a really, really powerful song that I wrote with A.J. Croce, who's fantastic. We met at the Ryman backstage, hit it off. We said, let's try to write something. Went over to his house, and we wrote this really good song. So I'm really proud of it, and that comes out, and then the album will follow with some other singles as well in May. But I just, I, you know, I, I'm starting to play these new songs now, and I'm inserting them more and more into the set. Really, at this point, the show is actually almost all new songs. And occasionally, and I play a few covers that I like older Delta Blues, that kind of thing. And then at the end, I play a few Hall & Oates songs, but not many. And it's interesting because when I first started doing this a few years ago, people came with the expectation that they were going to hear Hall & Oates songs. And I have no desire to play half of a Hall & Oates show. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
It gets boring.
Yeah, it's just, I've done that. Yeah. And, you know, it's, for me, that's over. I've moved on and I feel kind of liberated from that. And now it's really, it's even more satisfying to know that when I go into a show, that people now are not expecting that. And they want to hear these new songs. And what I also learned is if you set up a new song with a story, and you put that new song into some sort of context for the audience, give them a little background, maybe a little glimpse into the inspiration that made that song what it is, they hear it as a song they know. It's really weird. I've learned that. And the better I am at setting the song up, the better they respond to this song that they've never heard before. But yet they respond as if they've heard it. It's interesting.
Last question now, because I know you have a South By panel to get to. Smart people tend to ask themselves a lot of questions. Accomplished people ask themselves a lot of questions, and there's typically one overriding question at a given point in time. You're a really bright dude. You still have that youthful spirit. 75, you've probably asked yourself a lot of questions. Is there that one overriding question going through your head right now? Other than, why am I on this podcast again?
Well, that's funny. No, actually, this is a great podcast, and your questions are fantastic.
Thank you.
No, you know, without being too morbid, my dad's 100, and he had a big scare about a month ago. We thought we were going to lose him, and he's still hanging in there. It really causes me to think about what's next on the cosmic spiritual level. And I think about that a lot. And I feel that that I've done everything I've ever wanted to do. There's nothing on the, you know, on the list that I haven't crossed off. And if there is, I don't care. And so I'm really starting to think about I'm just thinking about the next, wherever that's going to take me. And I know where my father's going. And he's a good man. And it's an interesting to be around him and see the experience and the emotional transition that he's going to, because he, you know, let's face it, he's 100. He'll be 101 in July if he makes it that far. And he's going to transition. And when he transitions, it's not only is it the end of a generation, you know, it's the end of, you know, something for my family, and very profound for my family. But it's the end of the greatest generation, the men and women who experienced World War II, which is really one of the most important things that ever has happened in Western civilization.
Oh, yeah.
So I think about stuff like that.
Is your dad instrumental in who and what you are as a person?
Not musically. No, neither my mom or my dad were musical, but they were supportive.
What about as a human?
Yeah. He's a good man.
Wow. Yeah. That's great to hear. And thank you so much for sharing that story, because... at your current standing, you could be any number of things right now. You are somebody who is in the present, who is always looking forward. You are incredibly gracious and thankful for what you have. You look to give back as well, as part of just being content with who and what you are right now. And I think it is so healthy and something that is worth others looking into and looking at a little bit more as a sort of inspiration as well. John, thank you so much for the time today. Sorry, remind the people one more time when the new album is coming out, what it's called, and what that first single is, please.
It's called Reunion, and the single will come out April 3rd. There will be a series of singles that will follow, and the album will probably come out in May. It'll be a digital release only at this point, although we are talking about making some vinyl. I'm very excited about it. It's a mature album. There's a lot of thoughtful music in it, and it's mostly acoustic.
Cool. Well, John, thank you so much for the time today.
Thanks, man. That was a great interview.
Thanks to Gentleman Jesus for the intro and outro music. Hear more of his work at gentlemanjesus.com. And thanks to you for hanging out. For more of the show and to connect on social media, visit booksonpod.com. We'll talk to you next time on Books on Pod.